Hey guys, this is Patrick Carnes-Sedemoon. You might know me as the guy with the most IM medals in the world. Pleasure being here.
Right, I'm here for another episode of Talk to Thorin, and my guest for this one is going to be Ross R, who is, his official title is listed as Strategy and Analysis Lead at Fnatic since 2022. So obviously he will help explain to us what that means. So here's the first place we'll start. Just give me a little outline here, Ross, for people. You're obviously not a famous front-facing person who's been in a lot of media. If people don't know, like, what does that title even mean, for example? Like, I mean, to me, it's a little bit of a corporate title. I'm not sure what it means myself. Like, when it says strategy, is that coach? Analysis, is that, like, again, is that like analysis as a data analyst? So what does this role in, or this role entail, or this job entail?
Yeah, so it was kind of a made up when I met Patrick and Stuart, who are like the PG Central Fnatic team. When I met them for the first time, it was kind of, it wasn't really a role in esports traditionally. The way I kind of would have thought about it at the start when I met them, I was like, technical director is kind of the way I thought about it, like you have in Premier League teams or in La Liga teams. But it was kind of like we had team directors already in our kind of each team. We have like a CEO of each of our rosters, and that's their team director. So
is the premise of that role that gets the person who both like is involved with development, but also like hiring the coach and stuff? Is that the idea of like technical director?
Yeah. So So it's a lot of working out like who your analytics team, who are the backroom staff, the coaching staff, were very kind of niche focuses on data and analytics. So, but really the role that kind of, when I talked about it for a while with Patrick and Karen, who's our CGO, we kind of came up with something where it's like kind of somewhat all encompassing and kind of figured out as we go along, because there was a lot of, obviously we wanted to level up and become better at using data and analytics and take as many learnings as we could from traditional sports and bring them across to esports. Because I pitched it essentially as I've always been of the view that esports is really like the holy grail for data and analytics.
Oh, sure, of course. You
know, really, like a lot of the reason it's taken traditional sports so long to get to where it is today is because it's played in like a real world environment.
Of course, our games are you need the cameras and everything. Yeah, I mean, obviously the genius of the game engines, you can track everything inside the Counter Strike engine to where it is. Yeah.
Everything is there, yeah, from like millisecond to millisecond data where everyone's looking, every movement, every piece of utility, everything. So getting to grips with that, it's like it should just be the perfect playground for someone who's interested in that kind of stuff. So that's how I kind of pitched it. But then also the strategy side of it is there's more to like just how we invest in our titles and what players we acquire. There's also, you know, trying to get value for money in the market and understanding each market and each ecosystem, because they're all so different in esports, which was alien to me when I came. So that was a lot of like learning on the job and getting to grips with actually how does esports work, and what's the financing of it, and how do partnerships work, and all the revenues, digital revenues, all that kind of stuff. So it was a lot of learning and figuring out, you know, within our stable of rosters and kind of our portfolio of titles in esports, what were the ones that, you know, that really stood out as being, you know, jewels in our crown. And kind of we initially whittled it down to the titles that we really passionate about, and kind of Esports World Cup has changed that to some extent, and we, you know, you need to go wider and get more titles. But I focus primarily on our kind of core titles in Valor, League of Legends, and Counter-Strike.
Right, there's going to be some quite interesting stuff that's like inside baseball, behind the scenes things that we can talk about soon. But I thought, since you're not as well known a person, just give me a little bit of your background, because this interview is going to be about CS, and even though you're doing a general role, like you say, more than just CS, we're going to make this one CS focused. Maybe in the future I'll do a league one. But in CS, what is your background in like competitive CS? You were in the UK scene. What teams were you working with? What might people vaguely remember you from?
Yeah. So I'm from the West Galway in the west of Ireland, and I started out playing the game and was pretty shit. But I got to know like a lot of the players in the Irish scene, and the only kind of notable players in CS:GO were Wyndanski and Connor, who I got to know. And Wyndanski, you probably know, was around for a long time in Source. And those guys kind of brought me into work with them and Boaster and JKM, the UK JKM, and Loza when XL were in Counter-Strike. And they had Gfinity, that Elite Series was being brought out. And I was really I was super interested in Counter-Strike strategy. And I thought that there was so much still that was yet to be unearthed in that. And I was really passionate about that at the time. And we did kind of two seasons of that show. That was a great experience, but that wound down. Even when I was doing that Gfinity Elite Series, I was like, this isn't a business here, really. I don't think this makes much sense. Who's going to tune in to watch us? So after two seasons, that kind of wound down, and I had just really finished my formal education in finance. And the in-game leader from Excel was actually working at a kind of like fintech real estate company in London. And so he was like, you know, there's a job here for you, so come over and do it. And I was like, great. I started there and I worked there for kind of 4 years, and we've had like a great learning experience and living in London and working in finance and kind of developing through that role as super junior, and kind of finished out working as a kind of a senior analyst and essentially like building models and trying to forecast where things were headed. And then just prior to COVID, I saw that like Endpoint were kind of looking for a coach, and myself and Mighty Max got speaking, and that kind of kicked off that whole, whatever it was, two years at Endpoint, where I started out kind of as a coach, but really I didn't have the time really to commit completely to being a coach. And more and more time went on with CS. I was less interested in the in-game strategy. I still find it very interesting. I love watching CS. It's my favorite title for sure. But it got a bit, the anti-strat and that kind of stuff, all that became somewhat mundane to me. And I felt the thing where we could, especially at Endpoint, where we could kind of like edge out the most gain over other teams, was just signing really young aspirational players.
Oh, sure.
Yet to kind of, because once players have reached HLTV, the game is kind of up at that stage. If they're like playing a lot of games on HLTV, it's, for us at Endpoint, it was like the game is, you know, we've missed the boat. So we really started to go like drill down and go into like face the data and where they were trending, and looking at like the leagues that were feeding into FPLC, and trying to map out the trajectory of younger players and see if they were following similar trajectories as players who had obviously gone through the face the platform and gone through FPLC, gone to FPL. What were the kind of key milestones and metrics that those players were hitting after like 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 games on face it? And if they were hitting those, we would just add them to a list and keep track of them and see how they trended over time, and try and at times help them get invites to FPLC. I remember like even Nikodos back when I was on Excel, I remember writing the letter to FPLC to get him in.
Right.
And he qualified to FPL in like his first season. So those, that, like, owe a lot to face it and that platform as a route to like a path to pro. I get really, and I think matchmaking is just such a, it's one thing that the traditional sport would love to have, like what we have in terms of solo queue and matchmaking. It's so valuable. Players might not think that matchmaking matters, but it matters so much, because every young player grows up playing through those systems. So as long as that you're hitting kind of key markers and you're, you know, if you're an AWPer or if you're an anchor or if you're an entry in CS, as long as you're kind of following a similar trajectory as players that have gone ahead of you on the face of platform, then you're kind of in good stead to, there's a chance that you might make it. So that was kind of the logic at, and also a lot of the time these players as well that we would send, they'd have a couple of games on HLTV. So we would do a bit of like eye test as well, and you would check them out, and you'd see, and I'd sit down with some of them, with Mighty Max or Surreal or whoever, and we'd watch a few of the games, and, you know, or if they were playing live games, we'd sit down and watch them. And that was kind of all it really was. And it was easier then. It's far more competitive now. It's far tougher in CS. Also, there's other things that are happening where the player base is trending in a direction away from probably Western Europe in terms of dominant areas. Unsure what the cause of that is. You know, it could be somewhat happening, I think, in a lot of these sports titles. But we need to kind of, as well, it's for us at Fnatic as well, to get to grips with that. It's like, well, if this demographic is shifting towards, you know, CIS or Eastern Europe, it's like we need to have staff, and we need to have people that understand that region. So all those kind of things, that's kind of what we were doing at Endpoint is a junior version of now kind of what we try to do at Fnatic. But it's, the stakes are obviously far, far higher at Fnatic. At Endpoint, I could roll the dice with any player and be like, if it didn't work out, it was like, okay, well, whatever. And there was no expectation, except for that we were very lucky, and we kind of just hit. We sold Thomas. We got Flames. We sold Flames. We got Mezzi. Then we sold Mezzi. We got Boros. We got Nerds. Sold Nerds. And then I was kind of finished at that stage. I think Heavy God joined just as I kind of as I was leaving. So they had kind of a, yeah, it was a fruitful period, and it was great fun at that point. I think that the management, everything, the structure there, they were very trusting and gave kind of, and the players, I couldn't have like asked for a group of players that were so willing to, like, because it's so rare that people who have 1,000 games or whatever on HLTV, you bring in a 16-year-old and say, well, these are the skill sets of this player, because we would look at them and think, okay, because each player you would sign is a different, like they've come through the Faceit system and they've built their whole how they win on Faceit. They've built it over thousands of games, and so, you know, bringing them in and then asking them to change that and asking them to then perform, it just didn't make sense. But we were very fortunate. We had a group of players that, like, once we brought them into practice and they saw that, like, I think in the first day we had Flames and he won some outrageous clutch against Navi, and like the players, it's so easy to win the carry the, if they see that there's something special there, that they'll give him all those roles because they see him, that player, as a path to success, to qualifying for majors or ultimately selling the player on. But that became kind of somewhat tenuous, that process of selling a player, trying to replace him, selling a player, trying to replace him. It's so we built, I worked with the ownership at Endpoint to introduce a systems where the players that were kind of there for an extended period, so if they had been at Endpoint for whatever it was, 24 months, without going out of the roster for that period or whatever, they would essentially own equity in one another. So you would, like, if we sold a player, that they would own a
proper
player. So it kind of, it was a weird system in that, you know, it aligned everyone's interests in some ways, but also it made it a bit of felt like a bit of a chop shop at times. So it was, we wanted to do really well, but it's just so hard to retain players. It is so tough. Once any of the kind of like tier one teams found like struggles, immediately they'd be at our door looking at our players. And also, once you sell one player and they go to another team and they're quite successful, then that opens the door to people thinking that, well, players that were at Endpoint have a pedigree, or they've learned from the players that were there and they're probably going to succeed. So it's just like a self-fulfilling prophecy that we had to kind of tackle. But yeah, and left Endpoint then kind of after the Armor in Bucharest, or kind of just-ish before it. That was the last kind of, we had Boros and Nerds at that stage, and then that was kind of my departure. But I loved my time there. And the players, like, it was so great. And then, so I took kind of a period where, but like, the company I was at IPO'd, and it was kind of like after that, it was like a year after that I stayed at the company. And then it was like serendipity that I think I had sold Mezzi to Fnatic. And so I met Karen through that process. And then we had a lot of like ongoing conversations. He kind of reached out to me after I'd kind of left Endpoint, just checking in with me what I thought of players, whatever it may be. And one thing led to another, and he was like, you know, would you be interested in coming to Fnatic? And it was just good timing for me. If I was ever going to try esports and do it full time, as I may as well give it a go now. And yeah, it's been a blast so far. I wouldn't change it.
By the way, just to rewind a bit, as you said, when you were at Endpoint, I mean, you ran the list off there. It's actually a pretty insane list. Like, it is people like Flames, Mezzi, Boros, Nerds. Like, these are all players that people don't know who've either, like, been relevant in, like, tier one events, or they've been in some of the biggest teams in the game. And if you notice, also, I would say that list of players, maybe with the exception of Mezzi, is basically, like, they're all super, like, skilled players. That's even the thing they're famous for. These are, like, star players who've gone on to be, like, I mean, obviously, people like Nerds are literally some of the best players in the world. Does that mean at Endpoint, you said at Endpoint a lot of it was things like you find a player who's unknown, but there's a bit of like eye test involved and you look at them play a bit, right? Obviously, since we're talking about a few years ago, people didn't have a lot of tech to do stuff with. And as you say, the data is fairly limited. Like, put it this way, my sort of facetious mean way to make fun of HLTV always was, you know, when they used to do that series from about 5-6 years ago where it was going one for the future, spoiler, every single time, guys, it was someone already known in tier 2 or tier 3 who, no joke, is doing like donk numbers of like 1.5 rating. It's like, bro, that they didn't really take an eye test to figure that out. All you did is look at the number being broken on the rating and go, are you not even saying he's going to be good? You're just going, maybe he's good. It's like, anyone could do that. But as you say, the problem, and this is why it's perfect that you say in the setting you were in Endpoint, is when you're in a team like Endpoint, the second one of those players hits that level, already you're not going to get them. Like, they're going to go to a top team, or the joke is they're going to join a team better than Endpoint already as their first team, right? When you were at the point where you're trying to find these people who, in general, like I said, the track record's pretty good, you've found these people who could be top talents. Is there like a different way to look at, like, was it like you say, you're looking at the lower levels of FPL? Do you ask players for it? What was it before there was tools and sort of systems in place? What was your sort of approach to how do you even get a whiff of a player like this? How do you get a sense that they're out there?
Yeah, it was, as I said, it was a lot easier, I think, because it was a lot less competitive. There's just so many pro teams.
Well, there's all the academy teams now as well and all that shit, isn't there, sure?
Yeah, I think I was looking at recently. It was like over 70 like actual professional teams in Europe. But back then, it wasn't it wasn't as many.
Yeah, so yeah, sure.
It's proper tough. But back there was so I would have looked like the data part of it was quite there was it was limited in some ways. As in face, it does have an API that you have access to, but it's not like overly robust. Sure. But even people like Leadify, who, you know, I used to reach out to those guys, and they would have quite robust data sets. Like, it was a great, until recently, it was a great model that people would sign up, and as long as you had access to one player, you would access to the other nine players in that game. So right. They could build out such a right. huge picture of players. And over thousands of games, you'd get quite, even though it's quite linear metrics and simple metrics, you know, over a large enough sample size, and then you could just benchmark it against other players. It was quite easy. And then also I had like a lot of people who played in FPLC, who there were these kind of like guys who played thousands and thousands of games in FPLC and had seen so many of the top players right. transition through right. that. So I would speak to them regularly about like you drop in and you see somebody in FPLC is averaging back when it was MR15. It was like if the player was averaging like 21 plus kills in FPLC, it was a pretty good player. And then the really great players were like, I think Zai was like 23. Remember Disco Doptimus was 23. Nikodos was 23. A lot of the guys who trend Boros as well, 24 or something like that, crazy. It's simple linear metrics as long as you just catch them earlier in the cycle. But the academy teams now and where the players are originating from in terms of region and the access you have to them. It's now coming from kind of more east, and they're being caught way earlier. But also, face it, have kind of been because FPL. I was never a big fan of FPL because nobody really played it. FPLC was the one where you had people playing, you know, every season, every month they'd be playing hundreds of games now. So it was a great kind of same in the same way that the top tier of like solo queue and League of Legends. It's you can't queue with you can't queue with friends. So you know, there's no biases there, and you have to just queue up on your own and make the best of it. So it was a great, those kind of ecosystems are so great to separate the best players. So yeah, it was a mixture of taking that. And then if they'd played some time on HLTV, we'd take those demos. So take the demos, parse some of the data from them and have a look at them and see where they are and just benchmark them against like the players who've gone on and done great things in CS. So it was pretty rudimentary. And I think that's like some good work has been done in CS in the last years, more around actually like decision making in the game, but that can be extrapolated into player evaluation models as well. But it's still, as we spoke about before, it's kind of like getting access to HLTV's data is kind of that's the golden goose. If we had an API to take their data and build models off the back of it, it would be fantastic. And maybe that's something that'll be in the future. Maybe they'll license it or whatever, but TBC on that one. So yeah, it was pretty rudimentary at that point, but it was easier time as well. And the risks and the stakes were very low. So it was easy to take big risks when, sure. when there's so little at stake. Where you know, a Fnatic or any of the like the bigger organizations, taking these punts on young players can result in not qualifying for majors or not achieving the goals of the organization and not kind of not appeasing the fans. So it's a much tougher job for sure.
One sort of broad question I would have, because it can draw in a lot of elements and that you can pick which ones you want to answer, would be, I'll just give a very brief point, which I've made on some talk shows, so some people might remember this, which is I often reference, even though this is from League of Legends, that one of the sort of breakthroughs in the paradigm of how you recruit in League of Legends of the last couple of years, you're aware of this, I know, is people literally made, I mean, I think it was either XL or Rogue, it was one of those teams. Someone had basically a tool, like an analyzer tool, essentially, where if people don't know, the quick way to explain is it sort of like it just checks everyone on the ladder in your region for your role for that champion character in the game, basically. And it just does stuff like it can measure metrics like, you know, are you like the 99th percentile on laning in League with this chat, whatever. Simple things, like, again, quite simple metrics, nothing amazing, no crazy formula, but essentially what I would say this has shown me, the paradigm break goes like this, because it actually, if people know the game Dota 2, it's funnily enough how in Dota 2 they recruit players anyway, but they did it manually, mate. They didn't do it with an analyzer. Bethesda. What people have basically figured out in these games, this is why I'm interested to see if it'll be a parallel to CS, is in the game, right, you can essentially recruit really talented players who know fuck all about the pro side of the game, as long as they're like really talented at like a carry role, classically. People don't know in Dota 2, it's basically what they do. You get the guy out of the 8K MMR player or whatever, he just becomes the mid laner, and then the idea is his brain is controlled by some genius, you know, 10-year veteran who plays the support role or jungler or something. Basically, in League, that's what people started to notice you could do, but using this tool, they realised. I mean, a famous example, I actually had Youngbok, who was the coach of XL at the time. He did an interview with me this year where he revealed a story he told me years ago, which is a ridiculous one, which if people don't know, the player who just won Worlds with T1, Zeus, the top laner, they'd used this tool years before he was in that team, and he was actually saying to his players, like, we should just get this guy, like, you know, he's like insanely cracked out. And because the players weren't on this trip, they don't know about this tool, they think it's old World of League, they were going like, who is he, some bloody no-name Korean, let's just get a European guy. So the point is, in League, not only do these tools exist, but again, they actually have a very impressive track record of finding good people. If people don't know, a lot of the people in the LCS now also have been talents that were found with this tool, especially a lot of Koreans, unsurprisingly, because you can just identify this guy as like cracked up mechanics, right? The logic, as far as I can tell, Ross, goes that people's mentality now, like the Dota example, is I'm not actually trying to find someone who's the complete package. It's very unlikely I'm going to find an unknown player, but who has like smart shot calling. What I can find, though, to kind of touch on what you were saying before about trying to find people, is if I just find someone who has like genuinely exceptional, like individual, like ability, like talent, and then crucially pick them so they're someone who's malleable. I ask around their teams, they're not a dickhead, they have like a good work ethic. The difference is we can sort of coach the rest up, we can put them in their roles, we can figure out what they do, we can strategize, we can get them a leader and stuff. So it's essentially a lot of the scouting seems like it's based on actually what people think you can't test, except with the eye test, which is kind of like how good is someone's ability to shoot with the guns. Is that actually in CS, is there something similar common? Is there a device? I heard rumors people have a similar tool where they can check like who the cracked out players are. So is there something similar coming? What would you say to this paradigm? Is there something about how you think about recruiting and making teams now?
Yeah, so we the way I see data, and kind of think that it's us in our central team in London, we see it as being the thing that can save us so much time in off seasons, because not from just a perspective of, you know, is this player good or bad and therefore we should sign them. More, it has already saved us a lot of time by removing players that we would have spent time discussing in the past. Years gone by where in the old style of off-seasons and recruitment, you know, you would get the manager on the phone or get the coach on the phone and be like, you know, what players are you interested in? And then we would have to kind of trust, a lot of the time, trust them to be right in their prediction. In League of Legends, and I know Youngbok as well, League of Legends is like the solo queue system is like heaven. It's such a pure system, in that you queue on your own. There's elo-based systems, and you can build, which I think in the model that you're kind of talking about, it's kind of like an APM. It's like adjusted plus minus. They use it in NHL. So it's essentially you're adjusting for, you're in the game and you're the nine other players in the game. It adjusts like based on the skill level of each player in that game, you know, how much are you contributing and you know, are you kind of outperforming the relative market? And those models are used across all of sports. They're fantastic indicator for, is this player capable in the same way? Like, is this player capable of playing in the LEC? Is this player capable of winning the LEC? Is this player capable of winning a major in Counter-Strike, or, you know, or being in that same bracket as the absolute greats in the title? And that is what, and also, is this player not? And that's even more important because, you know, in like short, in transfer windows, which it's like things change every, you know, every 12 hours, things are changing constantly, that you are, you don't even have like waste time in those discussions.
By the way, just to emphasize this, for people who are missing that part, that really is actually sort of the based part of it. People might get the idea you can find a good player, but actually, as you're saying, just knowing to sort and don't waste my time on these 10 players can be bigger, right? Like, frees you up the more time to focus on the player you do want.
Yeah. And it also guarantees you that you'll never have players in your team that are not of that bracket.
Right.
So once you get to that, like that in those eight, like in those models, when you get to the absolute upper echelons, the efficacy of whether you know, the player in the 99.99 versus the player in 99.97, it's, you know, that is, it becomes trivial and meaningless. At that stage, it's like, okay, these players are, let's put them into a bracket, a cohort of like really good players. And now let's look at all the other parts, which are the parts that are so hard to deal with in esports, yes. Which is like the qualitative attributes. Are they like, what's their communication? Like, are they going to be, you know, are they going to be additive? Do they speak English? If they don't speak English, what do we need to do to you know, to help onboard them? What's that lag going to be like between onboarding them and getting them into team culture? Do we need a different coaches to help with them? So that's where the models are so useful, that you can just go, okay, fine. These are the players that we are interested in. They're all in that bracket of superhuman. Now let's find out more about them. And that in off seasons, like that's the stuff you can focus on then.
Yes.
And that is what is the hard part in sport, because yes. Like if sport was a science, it wouldn't be entertaining, it wouldn't be fun. So it's like you have to try and figure out like,
sure,
where the, and finding leaders in esports is like,
yeah
that is so hard. So you know you can put five guys together and they can be great individually in all their roles. Like you can, with data, you can look into how diverse they are in terms of their capabilities, you know, how they generate wins, all these things. But when it comes to like the human element of it, which is the thing that really at times separates teams in terms of longevity, and in the like those kind of key late, because these teams full of great players will always get to the late stages of seasons, late stages of tournaments, because they're that good individually. But then it's kind of, it gets tougher and tougher to when you play against these guys who are like veteran, you see it in CS, like the guys who are just, you know, built for the stage. That stuff, we can't quantify that.
Yes.
Like, no matter what we say, what we do, we find that stuff out, sure, as we go. Like even like me sitting with the player in an off season, speaking with them, and like, will I be able to say that this guy is like ice cold on the stage? If he's like a legacy player that's been around forever, yeah, for sure. But if he's someone that's 18, but also I also don't believe in that. There's like this barrier that people need a long prolonged period on the stage to become good. Like you gave the example of Dota, you know, we saw, you know, Anna and Thompson and whatever, a guy's just being pulled from the leaderboards like Monazi, any of these young kids, Rops, whoever it was, when, you know, they come straight from like Face It and they just instantly have impact in professional play. Like, so yes, they'll hone their skills and get better over time and become more mature and be better teammates, that stuff for sure. But when it comes to actually being able to perform, it's rare that people turn up and they have like major stage fright. It can happen for like a week or two, but they get over very quickly. They get used to the feeling of losing, and then they're just like, well, this is normal. I'm gonna get abuse, and I'm gonna get a stick from fans for a long time, and then they just roll with the punches and become pros, you know.
So, well, yeah, by the way,
that part of it,
one thing you say there that I would just like to hit again is I thought you also phrased that very interestingly. Like, basically, obviously the tool can't tell you any intangible. It can't tell you how will this person work with teammates, how will they communicate, how do they understand information, can they follow instructions. You can't tell that stuff. But as you said, there is like a certain baseline, though, of what these metrics can tell you. I mean, if we think of some of the names that you referenced, right, if you think of someone like Boros or Nerds, now look, I'm not being specific to these players, but I think people would say, like, obviously everyone loves Nerds, they think he's mega. A lot of people would say Boros maybe's had some problems, but the difference is you notice his problems aren't in the game. Like, I guarantee if that tool said this guy is sick, both of those players have unbelievable mechanics. Like, essentially if that tool says on whatever the metric is that they're at a certain percent, like the point is they might not have any other factor. Maybe one's Nerds and maybe one is Boros. Maybe it depends, you'd have to find out who they are to know if they're good for your team. But essentially the analyzer can't be wrong on certain things. Like, it has, like, that is like the reason I picked those two is because for me they're almost like, I know people won't get this because of all the stories about Boros outside of it, but his actual talent seems generational to me, mate. He seems like fucking insanely cracked out. I remember first watching him being like, who is this guy? Like, he's already aims better than like some of the top 20 players. So these players, like that part, I know people don't want to believe it because it sounds like some AI shit, like they're coming for our jobs, guys. But like the tool can, for things like raw mechanics, it sort of can tell who the upper echelon people are, right?
Yeah. And that isn't the great skill in sport has never been like just, who, you know, scouts identifying great players. They're very hit. They've been over the years hit and miss. It's like traditional, yes, scouting has been very hit and,
yes,
miss. And it's, to be honest, the success was really teams separated themselves by just having larger budgets, and that was it.
They went, yes, to market.
Bigger budgets, bigger scouts.
You just hire more scouts, sorry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. It's like you don't need to be a savant to be able to tell that, yes, Messi is going to be a great footballer. You know, you see him at 10 and like he's dribbling past everyone and scoring 10 goals a game. It's like, okay, well, you know, I'm a top scout now, I scouted Messi. Really, the great scouts in sports or great people at just spotting potential is when they also pair the soft skills as well.
Right.
So you can see, but it's what the data allows us to do is to put them into like a bracket of what's their ceiling. Sometimes it is wrong as well, and the ceiling can be higher, can be lower. But for the most part, it's the efficacy I've seen in the models is very high. So we can, especially you can look back as well in data and see how players have, where they've gone to versus at certain points in their, versus where they are in the kind of in that trajectory and kind of seeing where they finally arrive up. And it's like, you can see the efficacy is quite strong, but the value isn't just purely in like, okay, you know, we have models to identify players, but it's trying to surround those players then with like great coaching staff that can elevate them or make them feel comfortable and make them feel at home and make it easy. But also having like basic metrics to say that this player is great, that those metrics, if you don't delineate them by roles and break them down specifically into like in Counter-Strike, into maps, into positions, into buy rounds versus non-buy rounds, how everyone contributes to wins. And then Counter-Strike, the biggest one I feel is like players' propensity for risk and aggression. And you need that, really is like the key ingredient when you're baking a cake in CS. You need to have a nice balance of players who, yes, are, it's easier to peel players back from being hyper aggressive to being less aggressive.
Yes.
Because a lot of the time it's just, that's like a simple learning curve, because they'll realize that, well, actually it's better for me to be slightly more passive because I'll actually benefit more in the long run. But the opposite, I think it's harder for players who start from a point of, some players just prefer to play with more information.
Sure.
They back themselves to, once they have more information, that they can make better decisions, and that's fine. There's so many of the greatest players in CS ever have been those kind of players. But those kind of players only succeed in a team where they have players who are willing to take risk with less information and create space to just get it. Like, you see it in, we've had like a long period in Counter-Strike where we've had really sacrificial T-side in-game leaders who, when things go quiet on a map, they'll just run in and die to create space for their great players. I think that eventually Counter-Strike will move towards a direction where you'll have a number of players on the team who are willing to do those kind of things, and because they'll understand that that's the value, and also those people will just be more skilled individually. But I think, yeah, it's Counter-Strike is kind of, I think it's in a weird place where, yeah, we could be, it could be the holy grail for data, like, but we're yet to kind of get access to it, and when we do, that'll spur everyone on. So we can still do things at the moment, but they're just not as kind of groundbreaking as what everyone would like to see.
By the way, you could also make the argument that another reason why some of the top teams took a while to even build out these jobs like your job and make departments like this and take this approach is before they had academy teams, they were just treating literally Endpoint and other teams like that as a shit farm team and just saying, right, essentially, why would I need to scout them? You'll scout them into your team. And then, as you said, it became like a self-fulfilling prophecy, like Endpoint is a farm team. I know, by the way, the reason I bring this up is I'm mates with the people who run Ents, and they don't want that to be the rep that we're a farm team. You come and take play. They want it to be like, no, if you're a player in my team, don't worry, I can get the sponsorship and we can be at the top too. But they know that, like, both for the player and for the bigger orgs, if that becomes the paradigm, everyone will just come to you and go, and can I have your new good player? And then what they're doing is you're just doing the scouting for them at that point in time. Like, you're finding them Flames or Boros or Nerds, and then all they have to do, especially when there's only you and not many teams, they just have to come up with what at the time was a very small buyout, like a 50k buyout or something. Obviously now, the other reason why teams have to get their own division is, first of all, there isn't just an Endpoint. Everyone's doing this. And with the academy thing, people are doing what everyone figured out in football years ago, which is also when the risks way lower, like it's just an academy player, I can sign 10 of those and be wrong on 9 of them for not much money. And that way, as long as I get the one out of the 10 that's dope, that's very different to having to commit to one and put them in my main starting team. So what would you say to that? Because it feels like in your case, I can see why Fnatic hired you, have a very good pedigree, but it's all sort of an arms race. Like, for people who aren't aware, a lot of teams are trying to do what you're doing now, right? This is kind of like the new meta, essentially, is the way we're going to get around buyouts is we're going to try and find these people before they have a huge buyout, right?
Yeah, so it's the same reason that, you know, we don't have an academy at the moment. It's kind of, I think we're in that kind of, Fnatic Counter-Strike was in a transitionary phase, sure. I would say, from when I joined, and also just the way that everything that's been going on in the ecosystem, so much has changed. But for Counter-Strike, I think that the academies for a lot of esports titles, it's not that beneficial to have an academy on the basis that you are in a franchise league, you own the spot. It's like, if you want to play in this league, you have to play for us. That's not the case in Counter-Strike. And teams, you know, you can play for essentially anyone and qualify, especially going forward, qualify yes. for any event and qualify for the major. So really, and also CS doesn't have a contract database. It doesn't have a very visible system in terms yes. of what kind of restrictions players are under. And that kind of, that whole space is so opaque and so difficult to operate in. That's a lot of the reason why teams have organizations, because you can reach out to teams and either not get a response, get a hostile response, or get outrageous demands and have no visibility. And also a lot of the young players, and they're living on site with the owners of these organizations. It's a very difficult space to operate in. And that's why I think some of the academy projects have been absolutely outstanding in CS in the last few years. But I always think that if I was an agent in another life, I would recommend for players not to join academy teams and instead to join teams like Endpoint or the Gamer Legion have kind of made that kind of next step. But the teams that have a pedigree of signing players and giving them a platform to succeed, but also then giving them an out to other organizations, that's so important for players in terms of like protection and going somewhere where you know that there's a spotlight already on you because I'm playing at this organization and this they have a, when they sign players, it means something. That stuff is important, as opposed to being on an academy, maybe being on a really punitive contract or a long contract or a very high buyout, whatever it may be, but you're fixed to going to that more or less that parent team and opening up a spot. And sometimes that spot is filled by a player that has quite a
yes.
Quite a long career ahead of them. So you really have to back yourself sometimes in your academy, but their kids really being, and it's an exciting prospect. But I think Counter-Strike is just it's hyper competitive, as you say, and this is where things, that's why organizations, everyone is kind of thinking of how can we do these things better, because not only that, is you just want to be, you want to get value for money in every game. You want to see every investment relative to market. You want to be like edging out gains over your competitors. So it's like, I'm signing this player for X. Is that better than what you would expect relative to the performance that they can deliver? And that's kind of, that's the game. It's not just a game of like, okay, well, this player is available, but it's at an unrealistic cost. So you're trying to marry up, getting quality value for money, but also signing players at a point where they're trending in a positive direction, or they have really good upside potential. Because I think that, to kind of go on a more general point about like esports, if you look at like most of the esports, the titles, and especially in games with five people, most of those like legacy defining rosters across every time, there's been like one stalwart or two stalwart players that have defined that period, and sure. they've carried the team through all of it. Not carried, but they become like a magnet to attract other players and talent.
Oh, for sure.
So really, we should be in the process of either like players that we sign, they have to have that potential to ultimately be a factor for, I want to go play at Fnatic because they have X player. Like through the 2 years I've been here, the number of players I've spoken to in CS, the opportunity to play with, whether it's Zywoo or play with even like Blade at Navi, or like those things, they mean so much that the like financial side of it can be, it doesn't matter. Like if you offer them more money, they want to play with these players, or they want to play with the, so you need that like that chess piece, you need the queen to like attract the rest of the players. So that's the benefit of having an academy for sure, and having like getting to roll the dice with more players with less risk. And it's something that we've been thinking about for quite some time now. It's just that for Fnatic and where Counter-Strike has been, and to kind of touch on the like where when I joined Fnatic and where Counter-Strike was at, obviously the like the long period of success of the Swedish rosters and then transitioning to being international. But the thing that I know when I came first, and I was kind of doing like an appraisal of all our titles and looking at them, the thing that kind of stood out a lot was that the way the ecosystem was made up, and kind of the quasi franchising of ESL and Louvre and Blast, and that we were ESL partners but not Blast partners. And the way I kind of saw that at the time as things were going to continue to trend over time, that it was no matter what, we were going to be in a losing position, because if the calendar continued to be, because us and a couple of other teams were, it was weird. It's like you're on the inside, but you're on the outside as well. So it's like every year, Blast are kind of, and ESL and the Blast and ESL teams curate the calendar together. So over time, no matter what, it's like we're becoming less and less attractive to players to play. So it was such a just like hard in my mind to grasp how we solve for that long term. Like you can be completely on the outside and still qualify for majors. That's great. And force your way into these events. But you need to be just so absurdly successful and also play so much CS that, so it was a difficult one to solve for.
Sure.
But the, you know, the announcement that, you know, even though we were Louvre partners and those slots have value, really for us was a good thing. Like as in we have access to everything now in the ecosystem. So everything, it was going to, so it's changed Counter-Strike somewhat and kind of in psyche, I think, as well for us, the business like this and that. And we were partnered with Betify and all these things have like meant that Counter-Strike is such a, and it is such an important part of Fnatic, but it had like not fallen down the pecking order, but just it was just a difficult problem to solve for long term. When you think of that, like not having access to one of the big franchise leagues in perpetuity, and then speaking to players, and it being a thing that would always come up in conversations about, like, oh, are you are you guys thinking of joining Blast?
Sure. I mean, people maybe know the most famous example is that's apparently the reason why Nico didn't originally join Falcons, because at the time they didn't have any spots and he was sort of like, wait a minute, what am I doing? I won't be in like Blast. I think he had it clocked on, like, oh, I'll need that. That's maybe why he's going to go now, apparently, yeah. No, I'm bringing that up as an example because obviously like a huge player, but that is a real thing if people don't know. Like it's like you said about you can okay, the best example ever is Gamer Legion. Technically anyone could qualify to a major, Ross. The problem is even when you make the fucking final and almost win it, the players will instantly leave for all the big teams. Like it's just where it's going to be. So it doesn't matter if it's fucking Emma or Shui, they're all going to leave, aren't they, unfortunately, in that analogy, because as you say, like people want to be in the big leagues.
Yeah. So it was just, yeah, us not being in Blast, but being in ESL was, it looks like, you know, we were grouped in with, oh, we're one of the partner sure. teams, but really, like, every time we would have, you know, the your partner meetings, you'd be like, well, that doesn't really work great for us, that the,
sure.
you know, you work together in Blast and ESL to curate the calendar throughout the year, and then we also kind of can't play other events and stuff. So it really long-term wasn't, it just was going to hamstring us. So when we had heard the rumors that there was going to be this kind of dissolution of the quasi-franchising and a more open ecosystem, we were uncertain about what that ecosystem would look like. And still, I think that that's, let's see how things pan out. But it's more exciting for us because even though it's like the pie has been reduced, I think in terms of probably the revenues that are available through the league systems, the overall for us, it's better because we have access to all the leagues and all the franchising, so or non-franchising. So it's a, like, a new dawn in some ways, but yeah.
I do want to ask about some of the modern Fnatic players and obviously this team, but one question before we get there is, I thought I would ask, since you worked with Mezzi both when he was in the UK scene and then obviously when you joined Fnatic, as you say, one of your ins was, you were one of the people who sold him to Fnatic. And if people don't know, for me, Fnatic's like the middle period for me. There's like, well, he's in Cloud9 before, then in Fnatic, people remember, he even eventually became the in-game leader and then he got to join obviously Vitality and he's like 1 AM clone and has been in giant fucking tournaments and stuff. So what I would ask is this, the reason I would like to ask about this player is, I feel like still, even though, by the way, he's a very amiable personality, maybe it's because fans always have to have someone to blame. I feel like he is always the whipping boy in this bloody Vitality team, mate. Like, it's like they look at Zewu's score, and if he has a good score and then they lost the game, he's like, bloody. It's either Mezzi or Apex are the two. They just both get the whipping for the whole team, basically. Like, what would you say? Because one of the things I've been very impressed with, Ross, is everyone I talk to who's worked or played with Mezzi in the past says that one thing that actually isn't emphasized much is he's not the one picking all these roles. He's just the guy who really will do any role you ask him to do in the game, pretty much. He'll just sort of like won't grumble, he'll just get on with it and fucking watch the demo. So I've heard like all the basically what I've heard that probably will blow people's minds if they're only a modern day fan is I've heard he didn't really go like, can I sign up to be like the sort of like hard entry / support player / no. Apparently in the early days in the UK he was like a fragger, he was like just a good player, then he's basically just like a fill player, right? He'll just do whatever you want. Is this true?
Yeah, as in he's been kind of I think a victim of his own kind of niceness in some ways, I think.
Yes.
I think probably one of the few teams that maybe a Gamer Legion as well, but one of the few teams, while he was, had very short stint with us at Endpoint, I think we had him for about 2 months before we sold him to Fnatic, was one of the few times where he could just, we gave him all the best roles immediately.
Right.
And he was amazing. Like we gave him A on Mirage, A on CT on Overpass, and I think it was like him and Roy were like the highest rated players in the world at the time. And he is an amazing player and an amazing teammate. And I think everyone that I know that has ever played with him loves him. And I had the displeasure of selling him twice. Yeah, so that's not one I've enjoyed. But like everyone, you know, Crims, all the guys, everyone loved Will. Like such a brilliant teammate. And just that, I think that's what, in some ways, when you had a team like Vitality where they coming off the back of winning the major. When they brought in Flames, but the getting Mezzy was when Magus left. Yeah, that the someone that was going to come into a team with Flames, Sphinx, and Zywu, and then trying to take up some of the more desirable roles, not going to happen. So yeah, I think he is just and every team loves to have players like him who yes. are really great professionals. Brings a lot to practice as well. Does a lot of his own work. And just you can be so comfortable like, as a coach to just say to him, it's like, okay, well, you're going to play here, and know that he's going to go away, do all his prep, all his research, and be very capable to play in any of those roles. So, like, it made a lot of sense for Vitality. And sure, he was in game leading for us as well. Like, you know, he just took up whatever role we were like, you know, can you do this, Will? He's like, I'll give it a go, no problem. And sometimes you know, when you're as gifted as he is, you kind of just, or just players at level, you kind of want to be a bit of an asshole and be like, no, I want to keep my role here. But these people are so valued in esports, and the community might not see it as much, but other players see it as being one of the most valuable traits, because like, I want to play with that guy. Because even when we were before the whole domino effect of, because Flames going before he went to Vitality, that I was working him very hard, over a lot, trying to get him to come to Fnatic. He then goes there, and big sell for him to come to Fnatic was to work with Will.
Right.
And then he goes there, and essentially, Will comes over to them then. So, it was kind of a, could have been great for us, but it flip-sided. But it was, Will deserved to go and win things. Like, and we weren't offering that at the time. And that was, like, I'd never begrudge players who want to go somewhere, and especially play with like Zywu, Gem, like that. Those are amazing opportunities that we ideally want to have players like that people want to stay and play with, because they have faith, and that's kind of like, that's where we need to, that's where we're trying to trend to and get to. But it's been kind of a topsy-turvy kind of two steps forward, one step back at times over the last kind of year and a half.
The player in the current lineup I would ask about is actually the one with the least famous name. So obviously now you've got a bunch of players people know from Tier 1 and Tier 2. But I would actually ask about Matisse, because if people don't know, like, this is one of the players that actually, I'm pretty sure, by the way, I even know how people's minds work. I'm pretty sure when I made that tweet about this roster of Fnatic, I was like, it's sort of getting better. That's why, by the way, spoiler, someone from Fnatic I know, probably can't, let's just say for the sake of the interview, reached out and was like, you should just try to interview this guy, because he guessed that, like, obviously there's more to talk about than these are just good players. Like, this player to me, this must be an effective scouting, because this player wasn't anyone before this team, basically. But if you ever watch, it's just obvious he's got talent, mate. It's just like clearly, like, he's actually exactly the player, by the way, most people want in Europe, like aggressive rifle player who's young and malleable. Like, it sounds like it's just a great job of scouts. So give me some story on this guy. Why this player? How did you envision him, etc.?
Yeah, Matty's a funny one, because I looked at him back when we signed Boros, and he was in that same very similar kind of grouping and style of play, and the two of them had their big outlier attribute is their first blooded accuracy. It's not that they're like mega fast; it's that they're just, their first shot is so regularly headshots. Right. I think Matty is like, there's that that they have that stat in HLT of headshots. I think it's like, and Gux is it Gux? I can't remember. Grux. Grux is always one of the number one in that. Like, Scream used to be on it, but Boros was always there, and Matty is also there as well. Those players are the players that other players want to play with, because they create space and take on uncomfortable duels at times when, you know, other people, you know, we have a real mix of players now in terms of like, they're, you know, no one really has to, except for body in his in-game leading role. No one really has to give up too much of their like style in terms of playing passive or playing aggressive, because Matty is willing to go first all the time as well, but doesn't we? Alex, a lot of the time, body will tee him up, or Freddie as well. Crims is also another great person for being a good teammate and sacrificing roles and giving up positions and helping create space for other players. And that's kind of it. It's like you can send these guys in first and get entries, but a lot of the time, really, it's actually if you can send someone else to create that space so that then they can get two or even three. And yeah, he's just still. Yeah, he's still fine. It's his first time playing in an English-speaking team. You know, he's been making every effort, and we've kind of set up a lot of help around that and trying to get him to get to a place where he feels super comfortable communicating in English and working with the guys. And he's put in a lot of effort, but he's still very early doors for him. We haven't played many like big stage events or anything like that, so a lot of it is just still online, which is kind of his domain as well. So we need to get more, and next year, like it's going to be relentless, I think, with the LAN events. So that'll help him get more reps. But the guys, it's one of those things when he came very early on, and even Crims said it about him that he was just one of the most skilled players he's played with. And that's kind of normally when you hear those kind of things,
that's fire, yeah,
yeah, yeah. So you just have to try and get it out of them, and you know he's a super smart player as well, but when you have such great technical skills that you can put yourself in more uncomfortable positions and then still come out on top. Same thing with Simmer, Boris is similar. He put himself in really awkward spots but somehow find a way out of it. It's the same with Matty, like it's those moments when you're watching CS and you see players like, oh, this feels uncomfortable, but somehow they find a way out of it. Those players are they're gold dust. So he had like a lot of reps on HLTV as well, and it was it was a weird one that he hadn't been signed by someone else before, I actually thought. But it just came at a time where we need.
Yes.
You need players that have some upside potential, that aren't all known quantities. Because if you have that, you're just going to recycle players that are in the ecosystem and in the market already. And you like cannot win in any sport or any esport doing that. You have to find like the next player that's going to attract other players. And that was kind of the thought with Matty. But yeah, it's not all been hits. But he's one that we're like really excited about.
The funny thing is, on this current roster, I actually think the most slam dunk signing is itself one of the more controversial ones, which is obviously Blame F, because for some weird reason, this is a player, fans, it's just broken their fucking brains, mate. Like, they've just decided, like, a complete fantasy version of this player, which is they believe Blame F is a player who somehow, Ross, has played, like, tier one lands and majors, but somehow he never ever took a normal gun duel. He just only ever killed, like, eco people in the back or something, which is what's hilarious about that, like, weird, like, stereotype that has been forced on this player is Nero from HLTV did an article not that long ago, maybe like a month ago, where what he actually showed is what anyone with eye test would have known about Blame F all along. You know how he kills eco people? Yeah, he also on the good rounds just kills everyone too, you morons. Like, he was both one of the best rated players against ecos and against full buys. Like, and by the way, the full buy list was all the best players in Europe. Like, he was quite high up on that. So what I don't get about this angle is, like I say, to me this is a slam dunk. In fact, I'll be rude but also polite in this sense that, like, because Fnatic wasn't that good, I even low-key, mate, when he signed to your team, was like, I think he's actually overqualified for this team. Like, bro, this is a guy on the top team, will be a HLTV top player. Like, I'm sure he was hoping he would get, like, an offer from, like, a top five team. So did you have any concerns initially? Obviously, there's this weird rep. Obviously, people wonder why he's not in Strasse. Was there any concerns coming in? What have you thought about using him? How did you perceive him as a player?
Yeah, I guess with any player that you bring in, there's like, and getting to know them, meeting them. But we had a lot of kind of previous with Blame in through our coach Gita, who had worked with him at Complexity.
Oh, right, sure. Before.
Worked with him before that as well at was it Epsilon, I think, when he was there with Broken.
Right, okay.
Together. So, like, that was a great in for us, and their relationship and friendship was a strong thing that we could leverage. But also at the same time, yeah, at the point, as in where we were at a time as a team, and in theory shouldn't be attractive to a player that's whatever 4 years top 20 player.
Yeah,
it shouldn't make sense. But like, we we're all like, and this is the thing, we're always in the market for every player that's kind of available. We will like have that conversation with them. And
for that one though, you got to feel like, how's he dropped to us? Like, we got to take this. This is a slam dunk, right? Yeah.
I think it was a like moment in time as well where it probably Blame's stock was quite low in terms of the public perception.
Yes.
Versus his actual value. So, and that is the thing for where we were at with Fnatic, is that we needed to find those kind of key moments where players are kind of out of favor, and other the key teams that probably would be of interest aren't in the market to sign them. So it's like timing, good relationships and all that, and also it being a place where like he was very much sold on the concept of coming and working with Andreas and Jamie. And like, if you go and get references from all the players that have been here over the last number of years working within the team, it's a really nice team to work in, and environment and team environment.
Seems like some fairly chill people. Like, there's not a lot of troublemakers and stuff in this lineup. Yeah.
And it's very much, you'll see the guys at events as well. They do everything together, eat meals together, gym together. It's a really great place to work. So if in order for Benjamin to kind of get to where he wants and get that platform for success, kind of having a team environment where he's given essentially all the tools he needs in terms of his roles, not having to in-game lead anymore, all these kind of things. It was great timing for us and for him in some ways. It worked out, and it was like stretched out negotiation period and kind of like assessing his options, and there's other players in the space who also wanted it. He was sought after for sure, but I think what sold him was kind of coming and working with a coach that he knew, and also just a place where he would be quite a relaxed atmosphere, and there's not the same level of, you know, there's a lot of pressure playing in Denmark and playing for Astralis. So, and not needing to in-game meet anymore. And that was kind of
sure.
So, and kind of faith in Fnatic, and where we were kind of telling him, this is like, we need to sign players like Blame in order to attract other players down the line.
Yes. No, he's a perfect example of what you said earlier. That's the sort of player where if they're good, people want to come and play with them, right?
Yeah, that was killing us a lot of that, lot of discussions. It's like, who are the players that, like, people love Crims, like, and Freddie is one of the coolest guys and amazing to play with, but it's like, it's not the same Crims that would have been attractive a period ago. So we really didn't have any pieces that it was like, trying to sell Flames on the concept of coming to play at Mezzi, who was a good piece, but really it's not enough to attract a player who's kind of like coming out of his contract at OG, quite an exciting prospect. You need more pieces. You need something to excite people, and we kind of, you need those like franchise level players, and that's why I tell Blame. It's like that he can kind of be the platform for us to then, you know, expand the team and improve and get better, and kind of even with the signature of the good timing as well of being able to bring in Nauk and that, you know, all that. Being able to Blame, Freddie, you know, Mattis is an attractive talent. Like, Blame saw Matty and was like, okay, this guy, together the two of them can have quite a lot of impact.
By the way, that's also another aspect I think is underrated. They offset each other. Yeah, Blame's a bit more of a passive style. The Mattis guy's a lunatic. Like, they actually sort of offset each other a little bit. That's actually, like you say, that's also the thing about the Blame F dialogue that kills me, bro. Obviously, I wouldn't make a team of five Blame Fs, but I also wouldn't want a team of five Boros. You know what I mean? Like, you want balance. It's like a football team. You want some strikers and some defenders and some holding midfielders. Like, we all understand roles, guys.
I think your point, the stat that you mentioned, the eco thing. A big thing as well is it's not just like people getting eco kills is so important. It's so understated.
Yes, it is.
What happened? Like, we went through periods of the team. I've had this coaching. It's like you're almost frozen with anxiety against ecos because you feel like you already start the round with an advantage, and therefore you don't want to give up that advantage.
Yes.
So then your willingness to take risk is lower, and that is actually results in being worse. Someone dies, becomes even everything. You know, it just, that's how you get ecoed. Instead, you have players who are like, okay, these guys are on eco. I'm going to play the round very confidently. I'm going to get the first two openers, and then someone's going to swing and trade the other two guys. Like, having players that can do that, especially in like important games, that is, because when it gets to LAN, it gets to important games, if everyone is kind of afraid to take those
games, sure.
You play against good teams, good players, you play against like Nico or Zaiwu or these guys and they just have a deagle armor or they have a saved AK or something like that, you're going to get owned. So
yes.
There's so much value in having players that are willing to take those risks in eco rounds. But then like Flames and same singles for Nauk, their value then is that we have probably at this stage, we have probably too many players who are really good in clutch situations in Crims, Nauk and Blame. It's like they want to play those later on situations. They want to have more info because they back themselves to be able to make better decisions than the counterpart that's alive in the other team. So yeah, it's trying to find that. It's like baking a cake and having players that are willing to, and that's why as in Alex has to fill a lot of that. And Crims has to as well. Crims isn't notoriously an aggressive player either, but if he just adjusts for what the team
he can just do whatever you need to get. He's another fill type player in the air. By the way, I did actually want to ask, you're using a lot of the first names, so people don't know Alex's body, right?
So
I want to ask you about him actually, because again, this is another player where, because of in a past life, he was a player, obviously with Sharks and stuff on G2 way back in the day. He was a very different player. People don't know he was the up and coming guy then. He was just a rifler who just fit into the team. Right. In this team, obviously, from the Falcons onwards, he's been in, and whatever that French team was called, he's been an in game leader, right? Who is Boddy the in game leader? How is he different? Because I think a lot of people, sadly, just look at the name, think of the old player and go, wasn't that ages ago? And assume he's crap or something, right? As an in game leader, what are you envisioning around this guy? What's something you can tell us?
Yeah, I think this time in-game leading of Falcons, I wouldn't have put probably much kudos into that. I think it was very tumultuous, that team and that kind of environment, and was very short-lived. Like it really the in-game leading when he was in France is kind of, I think that's probably the better period, but really for him to in-game lead in English, I think our team, it was a newer kind of endeavor for him. But really a lot of the logic for Boddy versus, because we had Chris Dexter before, and we looked at a lot of other in-game leaders, people that are more kind of strategy focused or kind of, and also the more traditional kind of sacrificial, less impactful individual create space for other people. But a lot of the thought process that we had, and I believe quite strongly, is that unless you're FaZe and you have like Rops and you have Rain and you have four of the best players in the world, really you need to on CT side especially, you need someone who can hold their own and be impactful.
You can't just have the Mirage Bianc who dies every single round, no matter what, right?
Yeah, and I think you can see a kind of Navi probably don't have any like right now super outstanding individual that's like a generational talent. But they're really effective because they have an in-game leader as well who's not a bot.
That's true.
He can hold a gun, yep. And he can shoot. So part of the thing was that with Alex, because Alex is like really effective physical player, and that's a big thing as well. But he's growing into the role, and it's been, he would say himself, it's been difficult. It's changing the rosters, working with a really diverse, like Matty's first English-speaking team, and then Blame arriving. Changing Afro, who's a close friend of him, for Nauk.
Oh, sure.
A lot of adaptation for him, and a lot of different personalities in the team that he has to kind of get to grips with. That's a big part of being a game leader as well, is managing that side of the game. But he's, in recent months, he's been making so much effort to get more of a grip on the game and be more demanding of everyone. So it's still a learning process for him, for sure. But we kind of, a lot of the thought process was that this guy can still play as well. He's not just someone who's going to contribute to strats,
sure.
Contribute to the prac days. Because really, I think CS would move away from because that's what it was years ago. It was because teams didn't have a lot of resources. They needed an in-game leader who was really passionate about the in-game strategy and came to practice with new ideas.
Yes.
That day is gone. That day is so gone.
I mean, essentially, the IGL was like the coach himself back then, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And a lot of the guys who are the top IGLs now they've lived through that period. But not, like, eventually, it'll be the person will be involved. Of course, they'll always be involved. But really, they'll be prepped by a team around them who it's like this is the strat book. This is what we're introducing. This is how we think you should we should start the game with this. If it goes pear shaped, let's try this. But really, it's a ideally, in a world of Counter-Strike, the in-game leader is an important role for sure, because it's mostly important when things are going to
of course,
shift.
Yeah.
And you need someone to actually speak in moments where everyone's feeling really, shrunken down.
Yes.
But when a team is doing well and they're successful, it's decision by committee. It's a group of people, sure, who are vocal. You'll have one or two people who are always quiet, but the key players in the team will speak a lot. And we have that in abundance now with yes, Crims and Blame F and even Nock. And Maddie's getting better and better at it. So yeah, I've enjoyed working with Alex and onboarding him and everything. He's been a great addition.
By the way, I definitely, even though maybe we have different overall perspective, I definitely agree with that angle you put on it there, which is that I actually think specifically Carrigan, I always used to make the joke that it's almost like he baited all these other teams into making poor man's versions of FaZe Clan, because one, they all think, oh, it's okay if you're IGL to have like no frags. It's like, well, yeah, if he's Carrigan, and not only that, it can't just be Carrigan. He also has to have, like we say, like three top 20 players and like some cracked out veteran. Like, he has a pretty good fucking team. And by the way, even he's not making it work right now. So it's not the best advert ever. I know what you mean. People have gone down that route where they act like every team can be built that way. By the way, along those lines, one thing I did want to ask you is, what I actually found quite interesting about the current Fnatic is, in the era that you've been there, there never has been the gamble of, let's just wipe the deck and bring in like another squad and do that. It looks like, as far as I can tell, you have done sort of like a ship of Theseus, piece by piece, coming in and out. So what I want to ask is this, and we can make this like the last big topic, which is, what's kind of the vision for the Fnatic CS team? Because I actually think in the past, people tried a bunch of different options. Like, I would say the most historically tried and tested approach is you just get a core that has been good for a year or two, and then you add in a couple of players, because that way you sort of establish that you're going to have a baseline of like, they're going to play this way and they've got history and you know that they're like decent. I would say, if people have seen a lot of the like recent super teams the last few years, if they were built from scratch, they're insane gambles. Sometimes they just don't even get off the ground, mate. It's like they don't even have the like we say, maybe they have four passive players they find out, or the IGL doesn't work with the player, right? This approach you're taking, actually, essentially, if you're not good at your job, this team will not work, because you're actually having input in each of the players and you're gradually trying to remove a little bit of what you don't want and add a bit of what you do. So what's like the vision for you? Like, to you, in an ideal world, this core basically eventually gets like, I don't know, maybe a star player in the future or another one. You just gradually build up one or two and you just get to the top that way. It's not something where there's like a certain limit and then you would gamble on getting another squad. What's your vision for CS in that way? It sounds like it's tied into your ideology around the game, right?
Yeah, I think there have been opportunities to like take right, on, as you say, kind of those like complete overhauls and take on cores of rosters and stuff. But we in terms of philosophy, it's like we're just kind of trying to make Fnatic an attractive place for players to come again, and that in sport in general, that is the, it's so easy to maintain when you have it. So once you're at that pinnacle of being Manchester United or Man City, when you're at your best, everyone wants to play for you and they want to come to you, and they will hold off signing for
sure, yes,
to wait for you. We lost that in Counter-Strike. That like we had a diamond and it
by the way, you could even give the analogy, like you say, Man United's a great one. I know you're actually Irish, I don't know if you're a United fan, but one, they obviously used to be that team where everyone wanted to play for them. But the joke now is, everyone who's a United fan knows, anytime someone joins now, you're like, oh, wait, why is he joining? Oh, fuck, is there something wrong? Is he secretly injured? Can he only play in Serie A? Like, you actually get that feeling about the team now. It's kind of like you've almost inverted the vibe, haven't you? Where it's like, if someone joins now, you're like, it's a bit sus almost, isn't it?
Yeah, you have like, there's two routes to go. And even when I joined Fnatic, this is kind of the premise that I was kind of pitching them on. I was like, there are two routes you can go with trying to recapture greatness in sport. You can go the route that United tried to go at the start, where it was like firepower, spend, buy players in their peak and bring them immediately. Like, but what happened was they bought a lot of players who were actually past their peak, and the teams were happy enough to yep, sell to United.
A lot of dods and people where like you didn't know they were scoffed or whatever. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, just so they ended up burning money. Or you can go the, and that can work. The United approach can work if you get it right. It can work. It can work even in esports.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Even faster, because it's like a 5-man roster. Like Falcons will do it. That's what they're going to build, a team that's going to be successful.
I mean, you can argue the point is Falcons is just going to become Real Madrid. If every season you offer someone $100 million, eventually you can have a really good team. It's just inevitable, isn't it? Yeah. You know,
it's just it is just so much easier, yes, than esports, because it's just a 5-man roster.
Course.
Like, to do it for United to like, and for teams to recapture it in like, it's a squad. It's a,
sure,
it's a whole massive business that they have to, yes, to change. Like for us, we just need to get really need to find that one player that becomes our marquee piece. Yes. It was, like, it was devised for Stratus, IWU, Simple. Like, those guys, they transform. And that goes across all esports.
Yes.
So, but we need to get to a place where either we can attract those players when they're sought after by everyone, or we bring someone in so early on in that kind of process. But they're becoming more, even Manazi was, it was just so abundantly clear that he was amazing when he was at Navi Junior. Like as a child playing in like academy leagues, but was outstanding on Faceit, like amazing. And then immediately arrived onto HLTV. Everyone he played against, he just looked amazing. So it's not, but those players are identified so quickly. So you just want to be you want to get to a place where Fnatic is back in the discussion for, will those players come to us?
Right.
And that we're not just, because we're not net exiting our best players, all like Brolan, whoever it was, you know, in the past, all it's like losing your players to your competitors. Instead, we want to be like, it's fine to offload players if it means you're bringing in the next generation of great players. So it's about trying to recapture that. And it is that piecemeal, one piece at a time, and being really like just being in the market and being opportunistic and speaking with players and seeing if people are unhappy and that they might be interested in a change. Just always being, you know, having your finger on the pulse, because there will be moments where someone is out of favor but they're undervalued, and those are the players you kind of want to jump on. But it needs to be a nice mix. It needs to be a mix of established players that are performative, because we can't have all rookies. We need to,
sure,
need to qualify for majors. We need to, yes, compete. So it just needs to be a nice mix of players with loads of upside potential, and then players who will deliver in big games. And yeah, we've got a kind of I think we've got a pretty sweet mix now in that sense of like people who are ice cold in clutches, but also people who can just win the games, not single-handedly, but close to it. So yeah, the Oranmore is going to be an exciting one for sure.
Right, at the end of this interview, you gave a little bit there maybe. Do you have a final message? Do you have anyone to thank or say hello to?
I guess it's the CS fans. They've been through some tough periods at CS, but I would kind of reassure them that the title is important to Fnatic, and the opening up of the ecosystem, our partner now in Betify. It's like that we're primed now in a position to be aggressive in CS, and that's kind of the goal, is to try and get back to big stage games. Like, we've been too far away from that for too long, and it's just been, from my own perspective, it's been very frustrating and not enjoyable to watch. So yeah, it's just bear with us. There's method to the madness, and hopefully we'll get there soon enough.
Dr. Dre had NWA, DMX had the Rough Riders, and who is the crew holding me down, supporting me when necessary? It is, of course, my Patreon subscribers, the Skrilluminati. So this video, along with all the others on my channel, is kindly supported by Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Animosity, Bane Diesel, Jason, Jensen Gore, Tosh, Toucan, and you know who a special thanks goes out to, because it's always my main man, Jerky's Minion. Do you want to ask a question for my video AMA? Do you want to find out who are going to be the guests on future interview episodes? Do you want to know who the guests are on my talk shows? Or maybe you'd like to suggest a topic or a guest? Perhaps you even want to take part in one of those lengthy, tailored to you, discussions around esports that I do with the top tier donators. If any of those perks or others catch your fancy, then put your money where your mouth is, support me, and join the Skrilluminati today via the Patreon link, where in the description box below.